Chapter 24. Policy Directives. The Council of Genres is the administrative body that looks after all aspects of book world regulation, from making policy decisions in the main debating chamber to the day-to-day running of ordinary book world affairs, from furnishing plot devices to controlling the word supply coming in from the text sea. They oversee the Book Inspectorate, which governs which books are to be published and which are to be demolished, and also Text Grand Central and Jurisfiction, but only regarding policy. For the most part, they are even-handed but need to be watched, and that's where I come into the equation. I didn't go straight to either Jurisfiction or the Council of Genres, but instead went for a quiet walk in Wainwright's Pictorial Guide to the Lakeland Fells. I often go there when in a thoughtful or pensive mood, and although the line drawings that I climbed were not as beautiful nor as colourful as the real thing, they were peaceful and friendly, imbued as they were with a love of the fells that is seldom equalled or surpassed. I sat on the warm, sketched grass atop haystacks, threw a pebble into the tarn, and watched the drawn ripples radiate outward. I returned much refreshed an hour later. I found Thursday 5 still waiting for me in the seating area near the picture window with the view of the other towers. She stood up when I approached. "I'm sorry," she said. "Why?" I responded. "It wasn't your fault." "But it certainly wasn't yours." "That's the thing," I replied. "It was. She's a cadet. She has no responsibility. Her faults are mine." I stopped to think about what I'd just said. Thursday 1 through 4 was impetuous, passionate, and capable of almost uncontrollable rage. Her faults really were mine. I took a deep breath and looked at my watch. "Showtime," I murmured despondently. "Time for the policy directive meeting."
"Oh!"
exclaimed Thursday 5, and then searched through her bag until she found a small yellow book and a pen. "I hope that's not what I think it is."
"What do you think it is?"
"An autograph book." She said nothing and bit her lip. "If you even think about asking Harry Potter for an autograph, your day ends right now." She sighed and dropped the book back into her bag. The policy meeting was held in the main debating chamber. Jobsworth's chair was the large one behind the dais, with the seats on either side of him reserved for his closest aides and advisers. We arrived 20 minutes early, and were the first ones there. I sat down in my usual seat, to the left of where the genres would sit, and Thursday 5 sat just behind me. The reader meter was still clicking resolutely downward, and I looked absently around the chamber, trying to gather my thoughts. Along the side walls were paintings of various dignitaries who had distinguished themselves in one way or another during the Council of Genres rule. My own painting was two from the end, sandwiched between Paddington Bear and Henry Pooter.
"So, what's on the agenda?"
asked Thursday 5. I shrugged, having become somewhat ticked off with the whole process. I just wanted to go home, somewhere away from fiction and the parts of me I didn't much care for. "Who knows?" I said, in a nonchalant fashion. "Falling read rates, I imagine. Fundamentally, it's all there is." At that moment, the main doors were pushed open, and Jobsworth appeared, followed by his usual retinue of hangers-on. He saw me immediately, and chose a route that would take him past my desk.
"Good afternoon, Next," he said. "I heard you were recently suspended."
"It's an occupational hazard when you're working in the front line," I replied pointedly. Jobsworth had always been administration. If he understood the remark, he made no sign of it. I added, "Are you well, sir?"
"Can't complain. Which one's that?"
he asked, pointing to Thursday 5, in much the same way as you'd direct someone to the toilet. "Thursday 5, sir."
"You're making a mistake to fire the other one," said Jobsworth, addressing me. "I'd ask for a second or third opinion about her, if there was anyone left to ask. Nevertheless, the decision was yours, and I abide by it. The matter is closed."
I was down in the maintenance facility recently, I told him, and Isambard told me that the C of G had insisted on upgrading all the throughput conduits.
Really?
Replied Jobsworth vaguely.
I do wish he'd keep himself to himself.
He walked to the raised dais, sat in the central chair, and busied himself with his notes. The room fell silent, aside from the occasional click of the readometer as it heralded another drop in the Outland read rate. The next delegate to arrive was Colonel Barksdale, head of the C of G Combined Forces. He sat down four desks away without looking at me. We had not seen eye to eye much in the past, as I disliked his constant warmongering. Next to arrive was Baxter, the Senator's chief adviser, who flicked a distasteful look in my direction. In fact, all eight members of the directive panel, except for the equestrian Senator Black Beauty, didn't much like me. It wasn't surprising. I wasn't just the only Outlander member on the panel. I was the LBOCS, and consequently wielded the weapon that committees always feared, the veto. I tried to discharge my duties as well as I could, despite the enmity it brought. I could see Thursday 5 move expectantly every time the door opened, but apart from the usual 10 members of the committee and their staff, no one else turned up.
"Good afternoon, everyone," said Jobsworth, standing up to address us.
There weren't many of us in the debating chamber, but it was usually this way. Policy meetings were closed-door affairs.
"Sadly, I have to advise you that Mr. Harry Potter is unable to attend due to copyright restrictions, so we're going to leave the supplying characters for video games issue for another time."
There was a grumbling from the senators, and I noticed one or two put their autograph books back into their bags.
"Apologies for absence," continued Jobsworth. "Jacob Marley is too alive to attend. The Snork Maiden is at the hairdresser's. And Senator Zego is once more unavailable. So we'll begin. Item 1, the Gramercite problem. Mr. Bamford?"
Senator Bamford was a small man with wispy blonde hair and eyes that were so small they almost weren't there. He wore a blue coverall, very obviously under his senatorial robes, and had been in charge of what we called the Gramercite problem for almost four decades, seemingly to no avail. The predations of the little parasitical beasts upon the books on which they fed was damaging and a constant drain on resources. Despite culling in the past, their numbers were no smaller now than they'd ever been. Mass extermination was often suggested, something the naturalist genre was violently against. Pests they might be, but the young were cute and cuddly and had big eyes, which was definitely an evolutionary edge to secure survival. "The problem is so well known that I will not outline it here again, but suffice it to say that numbers of gramercites have risen dramatically over the years, and in order to keep the naturalists happy, I suggest we undertake a program of textualization whereby representative specimens of the 700 or so species will be preserved in long-winded accounts in dreary academic tomes. In that way, we can preserve the animal and even, if necessary, bring it back from extinction, yet still exterminate the species." Bamford sat down again, and Jobsworth asked for a show of hands. We all agreed. Gramercites were a pest and needed to be dealt with.
"Item 2, said Jobsworth. "Falling readership figures. Baxter?"
Baxter stood up and addressed the room. Although, to be honest, the other delegates, with the possible exception of Beauty, generally went with Jobsworth on everything. The person Baxter really needed to address was me. As the holder of the only veto, I was the one he would have to swing. "The falling readership figures have been a matter of some concern for a number of years now, and increased expenditure in the well of lost plots to construct thrilling new books has failed to grasp the imagination of the reading public. As head of the Readership Increasement Committee, I have been formulating some radical ideas to rekindle interest in novels." He turned over a paper and coughed before continuing. "After a fact-finding mission, conducted in the real world, I have decided that, Interactivity is the key word of the new generation. For many readers, books are too much of a one-sided conduit of information, and a new form of novel that allows its readers to choose where the story goes is the way forward.
"Isn't that the point of books?" asked Black Beauty, stamping his hoof angrily on the table and upsetting an inkwell. "The pleasure lies in the unfolding of the plots. Even if we know what must happen, how one arrives there is still entertaining."
"I couldn't agree with you more," remarked Baxter. "But our core readership is aging, and the world's youth is growing up without being in the habit of reading books."
"So what's your suggestion?" asked Jobsworth.
"To create a new form of book, an interactive book, that begins blank except for 10 or so basic characters. Then, as it is written, chapter by chapter, the readers are polled on whom they want to keep and whom they want to exclude. As soon as we know, we write the new section, and at the end of the new chapter, we poll the readers again. I call it a reality book show, life as it really is, with all the human interactions that make it so rich."
"And the boring bits as well?" I asked, recalling my only experience with reality TV.
"I don't suggest that every book should be this way," added Baxter hurriedly. "But we want to make books hip and appealing to the youth market. Society is moving on, and if we don't move with it, books, and we, will vanish."
As if to reinforce his argument, he waved a hand at the readometer, which dropped another 17 books by way of confirmation.
"Why don't we just write better books?" I asked.
"Because it's expensive, it's time-consuming, and there's no guarantee it will work," said Senator Amesworth, speaking for the first time. "From what I've seen of the real world, interactivity is a surefire hit. Baxter is right. The future is reality book shows based on democratic decision-making shared by the creators and the readers. Give people what they want, and in just the way they want it."
"Once the ball starts rolling downhill, it can't be stopped," I remarked. "This is the wrong route. I can feel it."
"Your loyalty is misplaced, Ms. Next. What could be wrong with offering readers choice? I say we vote on it. All those in favour of directing funds and resources to an interactive reality book project?"
They all raised their hands, except me and Senator Beauty. Me because I didn't agree with them, and Beauty because he had a hoof. It didn't matter. He was against it.
"As usual," growled Amesworth, "the contrarian amongst us knows better."
"Your objections, Ms. Next?" I took a deep breath. "The point is, ladies and gentlemen, that we're not in the book industry. This isn't a publishing meeting with sales targets, goals, market research, and focus groups. The book may be the delivery medium, but what we're actually peddling here is story. Humans like stories. Humans need stories. Stories are good. Stories work. Story clarifies and captures the essence of the human spirit. Story, in all its forms of life, of love, of knowledge, has traced the upward surge of mankind. And story, you mark my words, will be with the last human to draw breath. And we should be there too, supporting that one last person. I say we place our faith in good stories, well told, and leave the interactivity as the transient outlander fad that it is. Instead of being subservient to reader opinion, we should be leading it." I paused for a moment and stared at the sea of unconvinced faces. The readometer clicked down another 28 books.
"Listen, I'm as worried about falling read rates as anyone, but wild and desperate measures are not the answer. We've got to go back to the root cause and figure out why people prefer watching Samaritan Kidney Swap to reading a good book. If we can't create better books, then we should be doing a lot more than simply dreaming up gimmicks to pander to the lowest common denominator."
There was silence. I meant about 75% of it, but needed to get the message across. There should be room on this planet for Dr. Zhivago and extreme spatula makeover, but the scales had tipped far enough, and I didn't want them to go any further.
They all stared at me in silence as Jobsworth drummed his fingers on the desk.
"Does this mean you're exercising your veto?"
"It does." There was a collective groan from the other delegates, and I suddenly wondered if I'd gone too far. After all, they had the good of the bookworld as their priority, as did I, and it wasn't as though I'd come up with anything better.
"I'd like to conduct my own study group," I said, hoping that by using their own corporate buzzword language, I might get them to go for it, "and see if I can throw up any strategies to pursue. If I can't, we'll go with your interactivity idea, no matter how dumb it sounds."
"I see," intoned Jobsworth, as they all exchanged annoyed looks. "Since I know you too well to expect you to change your mind, we'll reappraise the situation in a week's time and move on. Next item?"
Colonel Barksdale stood up and looked at us all in the sombre manner in which he always imparted bad news. He never had anything else. In fact, I think he engineered bad news in order to have the pleasure of giving it. He'd been head of Bookworld Defence for the past 8 years, and clearly wanted to increase his game to include an intra-genre war or two. A chance to achieve greatness, if you like.
"I expect you've all heard about Speedy Muffler's recent threat to the stability of the book world."
We all mumbled our agreement.
"Good. Well, as security is my province, I want you all to agree to a plan of action that is both decisive and final. If Muffler can deploy a dirty bomb, then none of us are safe. Hardliners in ecclesiastical and feminist are ready to mobilize for war to protect their ideologies. And it is my opinion that a preemptive strike will show those immoral bastards that we mean business. I've 3 brigades of Danver clones ready and waiting to stream across the border. It won't take long. Racy novel is a ramshackle genre at best."
"Isn't war a bit hasty?" I persisted. "Muffler will try anything to punch above his weight. And even if he has developed a dirty bomb, he still has to deliver it. How's he going to smuggle something like that into Feminist? It's got one of the best protected frontiers in the book world."
"We have it on good authority that they might disguise it as a double entendre in a bedroom farce and deliver it up the rear entrance at comedy."
"Pure conjecture. What about good old-fashioned diplomacy? You could offer Muffler some well-surplus subtext, or even dialogue, to dilute the worst excesses of the genre. He'd probably respond favourably to it. And after all, they merely want to develop as a genre." Colonel Barksdale drummed his fingers impatiently and opened his mouth to speak. But Jobsworth beat him to it.
"That's the worry. Ecclesiastical is concerned that Racy Novel wants to undertake an expansionist policy. There's talk of their wanting to reoccupy the dehumanized zone. Besides," he added, "subtext and dialogue are up to almost 750 guineas a kilo."
"Do we know if they even have a dirty bomb?" I asked. "It might all be a bluff." Jobsworth signalled to Colonel Barksdale, who handed me a dossier marked "terribly secret."
"It's no bluff. We've been sent some rather disturbing reports regarding outbreaks of incongruous obscenity from as far away as drama. Charles Dickens, no less."
"Bleak House," I read from the sheet of paper I'd been handed. And I quote, "Sir Leicester leans back in his chair and breathlessly ejaculates."
"You see," said Barksdale, as the rest of the delegates muttered to themselves and shook their heads in a shocked manner. "And what about this one?"
He handed me another sheet of paper, this time from Thomas Hardy's Mayor of Casterbridge. The Mayor beheld the unattractive exterior of Farfrae's erection.
"And," he added, decisively, "we've got a character named Master Bates turning up all over Oliver Twist."
"Master Bates has always been called that," I pointed out. "We used to giggle over the name at school."
"Despite that," replied Colonel Barksdale, with no loss of confidence. "The other two are quite enough to have this taken extremely seriously. The Danver clones are ready. I only need your approval."
"It's called word drift." It was Thursday 5. The meeting had never seen such a flagrant lapse of protocol, and I would have thrown her out myself, but for the fact she had a point.
"I'm sorry," said Senator Jobsworth in a sarcastic tone. "I must have missed the meeting where the other Thursday was elected to the Security Council. Jurisfiction cadets must train. So I will overlook it this once. But one more word."
Unabashed, Thursday Five added,
"Did Senator Muffler send those examples to you?"
Senator Jobsworth wasted no time and called over his shoulder to one of the many Danver clones standing close by.
"Security? See that Thursday with the flower in her hair? She is to be returned to her..."
"She's with me," I said, staring at Jobsworth, who glared back dangerously. "And I vouch for her. She has opinions that I feel are worth listening to." Jobsworth and Barksdale went silent and looked at each other, wondering if there wasn't some sort of rule they could invoke. There wasn't. And it was for precisely these moments that the great Panjandrum had given me the veto, and to slow things down and make the Council of Genres think before it acted.
"Well," I said, "did Speedy Muffler send those examples to you?"
"Well, not perhaps as such," replied Colonel Barksdale with a shrug. "But the evidence is unequivocally compelling, and totally, absolutely without doubt."
"I contend," added Thursday Five, "that they are simply words whose meanings have meandered over the years, and those books were written with precisely the words you quoted us now, word drift."
"I hardly think that's likely, my dear," replied Jobsworth patronizingly.
"Oh, no," I countered. "Do you mean to tell me that when Lydia from Pride and Prejudice thinks of Brighton and the glories of the camp, its tents stretched forth in beauteous uniformity of lines, crowded with the young and the gay, that she might possibly mean something else?"
"Well, no, of course not," replied the Senator, suddenly feeling uncomfortable under the combined baleful stares of Thursday Five and me.
There was a mumbling among the other delegates, and I said, "Words change. Whoever sent these examples to you has an agenda, which is more about confrontation than a peaceful outcome to the crisis. I'm going to exercise my veto again. I suggest that a diplomatic resolution be attempted until we have irrefutable evidence that Muffler really has the capabilities he claims."
"This is bad judgment," growled Jobsworth, with barely controlled rage, as he rose from his seat and gathered his papers together. "You're on morally tricky ground if you side with Racy Novel."
"I'm on morally trickier ground if I don't," I replied. "I will not sanction a war on misplaced words in a few of the classics. Show me a blatantly unsubtle and badly written sex scene in To the Lighthouse, and I will personally lead the battle myself." Jobsworth stared at me, and I stared back angrily.
"By then, the damage will have been done. We want to stop them before they even get started," he insisted.
He paused and composed himself.
"Two vetoes in one day," he added. "You must be particularly pleased with yourself. I hope you have as many smart answers when smutty innuendo is sprinkled liberally across the second sex."
And without another word, he stormed from the meeting, closely followed by Barksdale, Baxter, and all the others, each of them making tut-tut noises and shaking their heads in a sickening display of inspired toadying. Only Senator Beauty wasn't with them. He shook his own head at me, in a gesture meaning, "Better you than me," and then trotted out. We were left in silence, aside from the readometer, which ominously dropped another 36 books. "That word drift explanation was really very good," I said to Thursday Five when we were back in the elevator.
"It was nothing, really."
"Nothing," I echoed. "Don't sell yourself short. You probably just averted a genre war."
"Time will tell. I meant to ask, you said you were the LBOCS. What does that mean?"
It means I'm the council's last bastion of common sense, because I'm from the outland. I have a better notion of independent thought than those in the generally deterministic book world. Nothing happens without my knowledge or comment.
That must make you unpopular sometimes.
No, I replied. It makes me unpopular all the time. We went back down to the jurisdiction offices for me to formally hand over my badge to Bradshaw, who took it from me without expression and resumed his work. I returned despondently to where Thursday 5 was waiting expectantly at my desk. It was the end of her assessment, and I knew she wanted to be put out of her misery one way or another. "There are 3 recommendations I can make," I began, sitting back in my chair. 1, for you to be put forward for further training. 2, for you to be returned to basic training. And 3, for you to leave the service entirely. I looked across at her and found myself staring back at me. It was the look I usually gave to the mirror, and it was disconcerting. But I had to be firm and make my decision based on her performance and suitability. "You were nearly eaten by a gramophone, and you would have let the Minotaur kill me," I began. "But on the plus side, you came up with the word drift explanation, which was pretty cool." She looked hopeful for a moment. "But I have to take all things under consideration, and without bias, either in your favour or against. The Minotaur episode was too important a failing for me to ignore, and much as I like your mildly eccentric ways, I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to recommend that you do not join jurisfiction, either now or in the future." She didn't say anything for a while, and looked as though she was about to cry, which she did a second or two later. She might have made a decent jurisfiction agent, but the chances of her getting herself killed were just too high for me to risk. On my graduation assignment, I was almost murdered by a bunch of emotion junkies inside Shadow the Sheepdog. Given the same situation, Thursday 5 wouldn't have survived, and I wasn't going to have that on my conscience. She wasn't just a version of me. She was something closer to family, and I didn't want her coming to any harm.
"I understand," she said between sniffs, dabbing at her nose with a lacy handkerchief.
She thanked me for my time, apologized again for the Minotaur, laid her badge on my desk, and vanished off into her book. I leaned back in my chair and sighed. What with firing both Thursdays, I'd really been giving myself a hard time today. I wanted to go home, but the power required for a transfictional jump to the Outland might be tricky on an empty stomach. I looked at my watch. It was only 4, and jurisfiction agents at that time liked to take tea. And to take tea, they generally liked to go to the best tea rooms in the book world, or anywhere else, for that matter.